City Foreign Relations Council hosts community programs to address topics of international interest. We thank our members, volunteers, and interns for making these forums possible since 1983, the year that Motorola introduced the first mobile phone. It's a long time ago. I want to acknowledge our university and community supporters, the University of Iowa's International Programs, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Center for Public Policy, and the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. And I also would like to thank today's special sponsors, Karen and Wally Chapel, and Midwest One Bank. I also thank City Channel 4 for professionally recording our programs for cablecast on City Channel 4 or 118-2, and also the UI Library's digital archives. Before we begin our program, however, I want to take a moment to recognize and thank 8 dedicated, experienced ICFRC student interns who have worked with us for several years and will be graduating this weekend. These outstanding students have really helped with making all of our programs possible, and I'd like to have whoever is here, please come up because we've got a special mug for you. So the 8 are Rachel Maggi, Fidel Estrada, Kyle Chapman, Ashley Chong, Daniel Valentin, Marcus Smith, Samuel Hoover, and Lucy Patterson. So come on up here.
Wow, do we have all 8 of you? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Huh? Does everybody have a mug?
I already have a mug.
Well, no, you should have a mug. Okay. You get a second one.
No.
Please join with me again in thanking these interns. They really have been outstanding. So now, it is my pleasure to introduce Kevin Kelly. Kevin has been a documentary filmmaker for over 3 decades. His work has been honored with 2 regional Emmy Awards, 2 CINE Golden Eagle Awards, and 3 New York Festival World Medals. His work has been screened at several prestigious film festivals, aired on HBO, PBS, and qualified for the short documentary category for the Academy Awards in 2001. Kelly has mentored other young filmmakers for over 3 decades who have gone on to work professionally for Oprah Winfrey, Warner Brothers, Lionsgate, and Saturday Night Live. And to many of you, he is probably best known as the director of the documentary film on Jackson Pollock, the mural that was done for the Art Museum. He is currently the artistic director for New Mile Media Arts, a nonprofit that educates and inspires through the art of filmmaking, presenting unique stories of common people in uncommon situations. His current project, Stout Hearted, George Stout, the Man Who Saved Art. The documentary tells the story of the University of Iowa art student who became the leader of the Monuments Men, a military special forces unit assigned to retrieve art stolen by the Nazis. It also explores Stout's pioneering efforts in art conservation, which elevated the discipline into the world of modern science. Many of his discoveries are used globally to restore masterworks and protect them from deterioration. So please join me. It's quite an honor to have Kevin Kelly here.
Well, thank you, Karen. And thank you, Ed, for having me. I'm going to talk a little bit today about telling local stories that appeal globally, and it's kind of a new discovery that I've had over the last few years. And I'm not saying that this is right for every filmmaker, but he has their own way of working. But this is something new that I want to really focus on. I mean, I grew up in Iowa. I grew up in Des Moines. And as a matter of fact, I saw a car today driving, and it had a bumper sticker on it that said, Des Moines, hell yes. And I thought, so maybe the town's changed a little bit, but I loved living there because when I was in high school, they had a film class, which was kind of unusual. So I was able, in the 70s, to make films, which was sort of an unusual thing. The thing about documentaries is that it's a format that's really admired by a lot of cultures all over the world. And there's hundreds of film festivals. Some of the big ones are in Amsterdam, Switzerland, and Paris. And oddly enough, there's no documentary category at Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival, which I thought is like, well, okay. But they showed a Michael Moore documentary there a few years ago. It was a special exception, but... And I met Michael Moore, and he says that he doesn't make documentaries. So I don't know how that worked out. But anyway, they had to categorize him somehow. The thing is with documentaries is access to see these films. And I'm talking about documentary films, not necessarily like, you know, a Nova episode or something on TV. Films that have an artistic approach and a message along with them. Back in the old days, you had to be in a major city to see documentaries and go to the art house to see those. And now we have places like Film Scene, which you can go in and actually watch a documentary on a large screen in the dark with an audience, just like it's supposed to be, instead of, you know, watching it on your iPhone or whatever. And Netflix and Amazon are also great places. There's streaming. And of course, PBS. So now there's a lot of access out there to see these kinds of films, and I was amazed that last year all the major nominated documentaries were available through Netflix and I think iTunes and Amazon and even some of the short documentaries, which I've made a few short documentaries myself. The other thing is. The technology of this business of filmmaking has really changed immensely. When I started out, it was 16 millimeter film that I used to shoot on, and I had a lot of interns when I was at the university that were I had an old Aeroflex camera in my office, and it had a wooden tripod, and the kids would come in and go, is that made out of wood? I go, yeah, because it was light. You know, we didn't have the titanium that, you know, you guys have. But 16 millimeter film was very expensive and very limiting for a documentary. I mean, in the 70s, I was in high school and college making 16 millimeter films. One reel of 400 feet at 24 frames per second cost $100. And then to develop it cost another $100. And today, that's $600. $100 is $600. So you have a $1,000 film that has no sound on it because that doesn't include sound. So it was very prohibiting. And that's what's so interesting about today is that with the digital technology, you know, you can go buy an SD card for $12, and that's, you know, what, 90 minutes. And the thing is, when you're making a documentary, you want to shoot a lot of film. And get a lot of, so you've got your story there, and so I'm real excited about how things have changed, and I also like it that when I was at the university, there were a lot of women that were interested in filmmaking, so we need to have their voices heard too in filmmaking. This is kind of a male dominated field, and it's nice to see women. Interested in this format. So, and I should say, I worked at the University of Iowa for 30 years, and now I'm retired, and I started the nonprofit New Mile Media Arts. So this notion of stories from your own backyard, I started thinking about this a lot, and I don't want to have it confused with like kind of a just you know, you'd have teachers tell me when I was an art student, draw what you know, or write what you know, and so it becomes very internalized. And you know, as an art, you know, I was living in Iowa, so it was like you go out and draw barns, go out and draw corn, and draw what you know. And but I don't know if that's what it really means, because I think it's more of create what you feel, because you know the subject, but you do have a feeling for it. And so I think that's kind of what I'm looking at when I'm trying to find these wonderful local stories that transcend to a larger audience. Find that emotional connection. I mean, we all are connected by emotions. You know, it's a universal feeling, and we like to have an emotional experience. I was talking to Ed earlier that one of the first emotional experiences I had from film was when my parents weren't around. I got to see the film Psycho on TV. And I'm not talking about the new Psycho to the students. This is the one from 1960, and the shower scene just blew me away. And I was totally frightened by it. But what I thought about that film was that it created that emotion. And it was just a two-dimensional, you know, image. And you never see any, you never see what's going on. It's all imagined. And also, I said, I want to do that. And I didn't know what that was. But really what it was editing. And the way that you're putting pictures together and arranging. So that's one of the my early experiences with film, that where I wanted to be a filmmaker. And the thing about documentaries versus these type, you know, narrative films or feature films, is that you certainly have the emotional impact. I mean, that's what a good film does. But with a documentary, you have that, but you also have the educational element, and also to be accurate, which a lot of times feature films don't do. And I'm working on a documentary right now that there was a feature film made about the subject, but the accuracy wasn't quite there. And we wanted to tell more of the true story, or the full story of the film that we're working on. You also want to be objective and not really sway with documentaries. That's really a pure documentary. I made a film a few years ago with Leo Biscaglia. Some of you might remember him. He was Dr. Love at USC. And when I made this film, he wrote me back and he said, "Well, what's the point? What's your point? What's your perspective? What are you trying to say?" And I told him, I said, "I'm not really trying to say anything. We're just presenting. We're presenting this information." It was called The Search for Meaning, and it was asking the eternal questions. And so we had, you know, Robert Schuller, who was the Crystal Cathedral guy. We had a guy who was, I think he was the president in Chicago of the Atheist Association. So we had all these different perspectives. So we weren't trying to tell you or preach to you, but we were just trying to open up, you know, discussion for this question. So I think that's what's really important for a documentary. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it. Sometimes you need to point out things in the world that are wrong and really be forceful about it. But you also have to be careful not to get trapped into your own, you know, personal bias. And there's a lot of misinformation out in the world these days. So I think it's important for the documentary filmmakers to be accurate and honest and do their research and tell the true story, the real story. The other thing about the backyard stories notion is that I would get a lot of people saying, "Hey, you know, there's having this pipeline thing happen. You got to run out there with your camera and start making a film about that." And that's great, except, you know, usually there's other filmmakers out there already on top of that with a bigger budget. And I don't know. I mean, I can appreciate the situation, but it's not a story that I feel I can really tell. And that's why I want to focus more on generating or taking stories that start here in Iowa. There's so many great stories here. I'm just blown away by how many wonderful stories there are to tell just right here. But yet to find that connection, that emotional connection with the information that's true, and put that together so you have a story that transcends globally. So people all over the world can watch this and understand that and have compassion for the character. And I'm going to show some clips of things that I did early on that helped me learn that. Because as a filmmaker, it's such an amazing tool to educate and get people to be interested in a subject. And there's lots of different styles that you can use. And I did want to talk about Albert Maisel, who was a filmmaker. He did Gimme Shelter and Gray's Garden. And I got to spend a day with Albert and talk with him. And he did a type of filmmaking called direct cinema, where he would basically just film things, and the story would unfold in front of the camera. And it took a long time to do these stories, but they're so honest. And it's a very rare thing. We don't have that direct cinema style anymore. I think audience tastes are a little different. And there's no narration in his films. There's no music track to tell you when to feel sad or to feel happy. It's just there, you know? And also the other, I think the first film I ever saw that he did was when the Beatles came to the United States. You kind of remember that, where they're coming down the TWA and they're waving. And that was Albert filming that. And he just followed them. And it's such a great document to go back and look at now. It's very pure filmmaking. I came to documentaries late. I wanted to make movies, of course, like a lot of younger people. They want to make movies and have actors and that sort of thing. And so I got a chance to work with a guy named Dave Gould. Some of you may know him. And he asked me if I wanted to make a film about Dan Gable. And I really didn't know who Dan Gable was, which is kind of stupid. And he said, oh, he's the wrestling coach. He won an Olympic gold medal and all this stuff. And he's got a great story. And I'm like, I didn't really want to make a wrestling movie. But the more he talked about him and I found out about his story, I thought, you know, this could be a really great story. I don't know if you know his story, but his sister was murdered in their home when he was very young, like 15 years of age. And he decided that his parents needed a distraction, and he wasn't good at anything except this one sport. So he strived to be the best at it. And I thought, okay, maybe we can work with that. And it turned out pretty good, and HBO bought it. And we had a great premiere here on campus a few years ago, and Governor Vilsack came, and Jim Leach was there. And it was wonderful to see everybody watch this film up on the big screen. So let's see. I'm going to try to show a clip. That first clip, okay, so I can use the mouse here. And this is a PC, I'm a Mac guy. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. You gotta double click it fast. Okay. Lights, please. Thank you.
For most of his life, Harold has lived in the same town, Mason City, Iowa. This town was the birthplace of Meredith Willson and the inspiration for The Music Man. Frank Lloyd Wright designed a house that was built here, and the Surf Ballroom, where Buddy Holly played his fatal last concert, is just a few minutes away. None of this, however, holds much interest for Harold. He instead frequents the Senior Center, the Rose Bowl Bowling Alley, and Pro Sandwich Shop.
Good quality steamed hamburger. No seasonings or anything.
Harold, a devout Catholic, lives in an assisted living apartment called Shalom Tower. It has the look and feel of a big dormitory for elderly people.
Cheat sheets! Look at that! Honestly!
Two rooms of clutter, minimal furniture, and a card table with a checkerboard set up is basically the extent of Harold's world. I don't think he ever had a girlfriend, or even dated, but one day he met a woman named Norma. And after 68 years of loneliness, he finally found the love of his life. According to Harold, she was the best thing that ever happened to him. A few years later, Norma convinced him to play in the Iowa State Checker Tournament. And to almost everyone's surprise, he won. But Norma wasn't surprised. She called the local newspapers, and when the stories came out, put the articles up on the wall. On the heels of victory, Norma and Harold made plans to go to the National Checker Tournament, but they never got there. Less than a month after the state tournament, Norma had a heart attack and died. Harold was devastated. He was contemplating suicide and checked himself into the hospital for depression. He's been fighting it ever since. Harold has rarely played checkers since Norma's death 6 years ago. However, the day I drove out in response to his desperate call, he had one request for me. He wanted to compete in the National Checker Tournament in Toledo, Ohio, and he wanted my help. Harold told me Norma would have wanted it that way. So what can I say? Besides, according to Harold, Toledo was only 700 miles away.
The American family, forever changing, shifting, and evolving. The family has always had a dramatic relationship on society, the marketplace, public policy, and the individual. Throughout history, this enduring tribe we call family has never been a completely perfect one. Although some view the present family as a failure and romanticize about a time when the family was secure and stable, it is becoming clearer that the ideal American family never existed at all.
If you don't have it in your heart and in your soul to live peacefully and comfortable with who you are, to have that self-esteem that is only brought to you by soul searching.
Every single horrific tragedy does have positive seeds to produce something beautiful.
Humans are really just hunks of protoplasm interacting with the environment for about 75 years. After 75 years, it's over. The corpse, the body, rots and become food for maggots.
We should stop being so concerned about all of these insignificant things that society puts labels on as important and start concentrating and focusing on what is truly important, and that is your life, your uniqueness, your beauty, the beauty of the world, the vastness of the world, and all there is to understand.
If I can beat evil case by case, if I can recognize right from wrong, if I can recognize and correct injustice for justice, this is man's spirituality for me. Then I am a man. Then I possess the spirit of man.
So that's where I started out. That was some of my earlier stuff that I did, and I start to get very interested in documentaries, and I was looking at those, and some of the that's kind of backwards, because the last two ones, The Family and the one on Search for Meaning, those were first before Gable and Checker King. And I could see the progression, because I started out, you know, I'm going to talk about the American family. It's huge, you know, it's a huge subject, you know. And I hadn't even been to Europe at the time when I was doing it. That's how naive I was. But we got to meet all these really interesting experts. And it was a time when gay families were very unique. You know, it's like, oh, okay, so you guys have families too? Just like us? And so that was very eye-opening at the time and wonderful. To be able to talk to all different kinds of people and learn about, you know, these subjects. And with the Search for Meaning, I think really, too, what happened was there's a woman at the beginning, and her name was Deborah Kiley, and she worked on ships, on small boats that would go down from the Gulf of from Maine down to Florida and take people's yachts down. That was where her job was. And she got in a storm and was lost at sea for 7 days and saw three of her friends eaten by sharks. And so she was in Cedar Rapids. And so we interviewed her. We don't know why, but we just thought, oh, that'd be, you know. And then we started putting it together with, there was a football player named I can't remember his name now, but this football player who played for the Bears, and he was in Chicago, and he was raised in Cabrini Green, and when he had a really wonderful, inspiring story about, you know, overcoming poverty. So we had him and her, and then Ernest Lustig, who was the Holocaust survivor, and we started to pair those with other experts, and that's how this whole notion of the Search for Meaning came about. It was a series that McGraw-Hill hired the university to do, and there were, I believe, 26 shows, and this is when I met my film partner at the time, Dave Gould, and we came up with this Search for Meaning idea. He said, well, you got mind and body. What about spirit? And they're going, oh, we can't do religion at the university. That's religious. I go, no, it's not. It's about spirituality. It's about asking the eternal question. And, you know, why are we here? I mean, don't you think that needs to be in the series, too, while you're doing your blood pressure and all that sort of thing and making sure you got the right calcium? And so they said yes, and it was great. And that won an Emmy Award. That was the only one out of the whole series that did. So we were glad that we did it. But it made me start thinking about this whole starting in your own backyard kind of thing of filmmaking, because that's where it really started from. And then as we went on to do Gable was just, you know, right across campus, and he was here, and so we were able to follow him and tell his story. And the other thing about documentaries is what I like to try to tell some of my students is that always expect the unexpected, and, you know, turn lemons into lemonade and all this sort of thing, because we were filming this guy, and he was coaching and all this, and he's very active when he coaches, and so we're filming it. Then he breaks his hip right in the middle of our film. We're like going, oh, great. He's going to be in the hospital for the rest of the movie and on crutches. But it was great because it was so typical of him, and his mentality is to overcome everything. And he, like the University Hospital, was saying, this guy recuperated faster than any patient we've ever had in the history of someone getting their hip healed. And it was wonderful. Cinematically, because he had these big crutches, and somebody made these titanium Hawkeye crutches, and he would go out and he would coach, and he'd point them like guns, like this, at these guys, like that. And I thought, man, this is, we got gold here. This was great. And so it really turned into an advantage and not a disadvantage with that one. And then the clip on the Checker King, that was my uncle. So I met him at a wedding and talked to him for a long time. And we got talking, and he wanted to. His wife had just died, and he wanted to do something. And I thought, well, that's, and Harold was a guy that never did anything. He was a bachelor till he was 68 years old. He's Irish, but you know, so he didn't get married until he, like, you know, later in life. And he finally found this woman who encouraged him to step back into life. And his life was playing checkers, and he was real good at it. So I asked him if I could follow him along the way, and it was great, because we went to Toledo, Ohio, and we went to the National Checker Tournament, and we filmed it, and it was like a Star Trek convention there. I was just like, it was just wild. And these guys are chewing tobacco and screaming about the opening rules and yelling and everything. And then they had a group from Barbados, which I thought, National Check? Well, you know, they had them come too, so... So it was pretty wild, and that film's online somewhere if you want to see it. It's about a half an hour, or 40, it's a 40-minute, it's a short. So then I started thinking about documentary film and how what I can do to make more of them, and I struggled and tried all kinds of things, and I got out of my element again. I actually did the later film I did after those was a film on an Iraqi doctor, and it... It's called, I can't remember the title of it. A Tale of Two Doctors, because it was about an Iraqi doctor and a doctor from the United States during the Iraq War. And it was a very powerful film, but, I mean, I was kind of out of my element. I was working with an international group and all, and the doctor, Salam Ishmal, he's from Baghdad, and he decided to go to Fallujah, if you remember that horrible event. So he was down there trying to help what he could, and... But it just was it went to like maybe one film festival. It wasn't something I probably should have been doing. So I learned a good lesson on that film, and then a few years later, I read in the newspaper, because I was an art major, and I knew what we had here at the university, and then I heard that they're going to try to sell our Jackson Pollock painting, and I thought, what? No, they're not going to sell that, and they really had a committee developed to sell this painting, and there was a bill written and everything. And so I thought, well, what can I do as a filmmaker to kind of like help? And I was just thinking, well, maybe I'll make a little short thing and I'll just go around on local TV and get people interested in it. And I met a guy named Sean O'Hara, who was crazy. And I love him because he was so interested in making this into a bigger film than what I was. And he convinced me to do this. And so we did this documentary on a painting, which is, you know, how do you do that? But I guess it's not really about the painting. It's about the story behind the painting. It's like any story you tell. There's always a story behind the story behind the story. And it was right here in our own backyard. So I felt, I can tell this story. I think I can do this. So we started making the film, and I have a clip here we can show, and I can talk a little bit about that. So double click, right?
It's hailed around the world as one of the masterpieces in Pollock's career.
The sheer physical size of mural was absolutely unprecedented for Pollock.
Peggy Guggenheim commissioned the picture after Mondrian and Duchamp gave her the nudge and said, this guy's really good.
That was unprecedented. And to the other artists, this was like hitting a home run in a World Series game.
The public was not familiar with this kind of art. They were mystified by it and sometimes disturbed by it.
The CIA becomes involved because the State Department organizes a few exhibits of American art and then ships them around Europe.
During the Cold War, abstract expressionism was advanced as the American art form. Regionalism was sort of viewed as communi-Nazi art.
Our artists are so free, they can make art that nobody understands or even likes, but it doesn't matter because in America we're all free.
And when Peggy Guggenheim decided to move back to Europe in 1947, she was looking at institutions that shared her approach to art and artists.
So she wrote to her friend Lester Longman and said, I'm shipping you a painting. You'll have to pay this shipment, but it's yours for free.
There was a huge discussion about how we would recover from the flood.
Congressman makes a requirement that the mural be sold.
It was valued, after all, at something around $150 million.
The Getty did a real service to humanity by restoring that picture.
My first question was, well, how big is it? And when he told me, I said, absolutely not, that's too big.
Mural is an icon. Its influence is absolutely enormous, and there's a ripple effect.
I mean, the Pollock mural is really a wonderful story of modernism's mobility.
So that was a really great experience. One little story I like to tell about that is we went to Italy, and they're bringing the painting, this huge painting, into Peggy Guggenheim's Palazzo, and my one cameraman got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and took a boat. Everything's, you know, it's an aquatic city. And so he took a boat out there to the railroad station, which was like maybe an hour or so away, to go film the dock and the painting coming and everything. And the Italians are great people. But I kept trying to get, okay, now where is the painting coming? Is it coming down the canal? Oh, yeah, that's where it's coming, you know. It's like, okay, great, you know. So are you sure? And what time is... Well, like 7 o'clock. I go, okay, all right, fine, great, that's wonderful. So my wife, who works with me on the films now, she was there, and so we set up on top of Peggy's museum, and we're pointing down the canal, and the sun's great. It's right behind, if you know about photography, the sun's right behind us. You know, it's beautiful. And so I'm getting my tripod set up. Don't even have the camera out yet. And my wife goes, there it is, it's coming. And I'm like, what? And so I look up, and there's this boat, and it's got this box about this size on it. And I'm like going, that's not the Pollock, that's something else. I don't know what that is. So we get the camera set up, and she goes, there it is, you know, it's coming the other way. And I'm like, what? They'd gone around the other way and come up the canal this way. So we had to quickly shift over and get the shot, but we got the shot, and that's that crane shot you see of it coming up. So I wanted to put that in the trailer because it was so hard to get. But so that was kind of fun. But we had a great time working on that film, and I'm glad a lot of people here in Iowa City really liked it because I've heard a lot of great things about it. My only regret was that we did try to contact some of the legislators that were wanting to sell the painting. And I worked really hard to try to get them on camera because I said, look, this is what you believe. You should say it. You've gone to all the trouble of putting it in writing and everything. Let me come and you tell your story, you know. I want this to be objective. I want all the story told, and we couldn't get it done. So sometimes, you know, try to be objective and, you know, not sway. You can't always quite pull that off. So that was one experience that we had with Mural. And that was the last production I did at the university, and so I retired in December, and I started a nonprofit called New Mile Media Arts, and we have 7 board members. One of the board members is here, and I won't tell you who it is. It's Joan, and she got me to come here. So, but we're working on a new film now, and it's called Stout-Hearted. It's about George Stout, who's from Winterset, Iowa. So again, a little Iowa connection. He actually came to the university and went to school here, and he actually taught art while he was here. So he was here for quite some time. And I've been working with a lot of historians, and the man who wrote the book, The Monuments Man. They made the movie with George Clooney. So we've talked with him. We've talked with Lynn Nicholas, who wrote The Rape of Europa, which was a very, very big book at the time. It was one of the first books about, you know, Hitler and the Nazi art. And so we got to speak with her. And as soon as I leave here, we're packed up already. We're going to Harvard to shoot some of the conservation people there. George Stout started at the Fog, and so we're going to be filming the new George Stout, who's there. And we're going to be talking to historians at the Fog. So I can show a trailer that we did for this. So it's pretty heavy-handed, though. It's not quite how I want the film to be, but it was a good marketing tool.
Mm-hmm. Throughout history, we have seen the destruction of culture through war and violence. Along with death and destruction, civilizations gravely suffer the loss of identity, namely, its art. One man who would eventually save millions of artworks was George Stout from Winterset, Iowa. After serving in World War I, he returned home to attend the University of Iowa. At the time, all students were required to take an art class, and Stout became interested in drawing. He expanded his love for art at Harvard, where he received a master's degree of art conservation and accepted a position at the university's Fogg Museum. Working alongside chemists and other scientists, he began developing new techniques in preserving art. He became head of Fogg's conservation department in 1933. But later that year in Germany, important and revolutionary works of art were being labeled as degenerate art and destroyed. A frustrated art student who was rejected twice from the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna was now in power. The artwork of Adolf Hitler, deemed acceptable, would be eternally exhibited in a new museum constructed by the Third Reich. The art was being seized and pilfered from Europe's finest museums and private collections. The war in Europe was taking America's young men into battle. But at age 46 and with two children to raise, George Stout enlisted in the armed forces. Because of his art experience, he was recruited to the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives section. The group was charged with protecting Europe's cultural monuments, as well as recovering and returning art plundered by the Nazis. This group would later be known as the Monuments Men, and they would embark on one of the greatest and most dangerous treasure hunts in history. Stout's group of art experts scoured Europe in search of art stolen by the Nazis, and although they lost two men, they were incredibly successful. They rescued works by Leonardo da Vinci, Rembrandt, and Michelangelo. By the end of their mission, Stout and his men had saved over 5 million works of art. After the war, Stout continued his work in art conservation and founded the International Institute for Conservation, never talking about his experiences during the war. Many of the world's finest works were deteriorating, and he was developing new techniques to prevent this. Even today, Stout's techniques are being used to preserve artwork around the world. Extending his legacy long after World War II and his death in 1978. George Stout, a modern Renaissance man, who saved and recovered some of the world's greatest artwork and whose restorative techniques are still being used to preserve the world's artistic treasures for generations to come.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise today to recognize art conservationist specialist George Stout. Mr. Speaker, please join me in honoring George Stout and the other Monuments Men for their invaluable efforts during World War II, and I yield back my time.
And we want to continue. I want to continue on making films that are have a connection here, where I live in Iowa, a place I love so much. I grew up here, and I know there's, like I said, there's so many great stories to tell, and we've got several stories that we've been approached with already for our nonprofit. I can't talk about them because they're not finalized yet. So, but we've got a lot of great Iowans and a lot of great people that have been through Iowa and have the connection here. And I guess I want to close by saying we always had this formula for telling stories through film, and it was the objective was it had to make you laugh, it had to make you cry, and it had to make you think. And so that's what I hope this next film that I'm working on will do for the audiences. And we'll be around. So thank you.
Well, we'll start with this one. What is the most important part of a documentary? The subject, the writing, the filming, or the editing? Or all of the above?
Yeah. It's the marketing. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm being a smart aleck. It's it's all of those. Those are all very, really important things. Because without all those, you really don't have, it doesn't hang together well. So it's but I think if I had to choose one thing, I think the subject does matter, because there are subjects that you try what you can and they just doesn't seem to really gel. So if I chose one of those, I would have to say the subject. And what I guess as far as a craft person, and what I've been told by other people in the, you know, other filmmakers, is that my strength is editing. I'm a film editor. That's what I do best. And so of course I like that, and I might like it too much sometimes, but I do like the power of being able to edit digitally like we can today. I mean, I'm back from the days of film again, where we would cut it celluloid strips and hang it on the wall, and you know, if you cut it too short, you had to go to the garbage can and get a frame out. I mean, we actually would do this and then tape it back together and send it off to the lab. So I like editing, of course, but I would have to say, to answer that question, it would be the subject.
Where and how do you procure your film music?
That's a great question. There are wonderful musicians who do scoring, and I've worked with a few of them. One of my favorite experiences was when we did The Checker King. I worked with John Rapson over at the music department, and John was saying, you know, your film really needs this person to do it. And it was a student, which I thought, oh, really? Okay. But he was just brilliant, and he wrote all the music for the film, and it was just great. And so I had such a great time working with the musicians scoring that story, because, you know, the music started to become a character with the character that was in the film, which really helped it along. Now, unfortunately, there's also music companies where you buy stuff now. So you can buy music beds, and it's gotten to a point where you can actually say, I want it to be longer, or I want it to be shorter, and they'll redo it for you. They'll actually work with you and score things that way. So I don't like to work that way. I like to use real people, but that's another thing that's become very popular.
What is your view of docudramas?
Oh, they're okay. I mean, if they're good, I mean, they're fine. I would never make one. I'd feel kind of awkward making a docudrama. But I can't think of a docudrama that comes to mind right now. But, you know, if it works, then that's great. So that's kind of my opinion about it. I don't know. Okay.
What criteria do the various academies use to determine their awards for documentaries?
I don't really know the answer to that question. It's just kind of, it's kind of a mystery. The Academy Awards works this way. If you, I don't know where it all started, but if you're a member of the Academy, then you vote. I mean, you might know that, like the actors vote for all the actors, and the editors all vote for the editors. And so it's, you know, it's a sort of a inside club that everybody, you know, knows each other. And so that's, unfortunately, how some of those films are chosen. And the thing about, you know, everybody will say stuff about the Academy Awards. I like the Academy Awards because I like that people are interested in film. It's, to me, it's my Super Bowl that night, because you get to see the filmmakers and get to be celebrated, and it also promotes filmmaking. I don't like the competition. I think that's kind of silly, but you got to give somebody a prize for something. But just the idea of the nomination, that's a real honor. If you get nominated, because it's really hard. We qualified in, oh, I think you're reading about that in
2001, and it's very hard to get to that stage, but I like to think that that was the year of 9/11, so they had to cut the program short that year. So instead of four nominees, they only had two. So our odds were cut down for that. But anyway, that's all I can say on that.
What did the Monuments Men most neglect?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really know that yet. That's a really good question. I'll come back when I have the answer to that. I have to think about that one. Wow, that's a great question. And then there's a.
Could you say something about saving Brinton?
Oh, I'm really proud of those guys. That's so cool. Their movie is really, really taken off. And like I was talking about with the Academy Awards, right now it's being screened in Los Angeles and New York. And that's the other thing about especially documentary filmmakers, is that it's all, the money has to come from somebody's heart, you know, it's not an investment thing. Well, we're going to invest in this film and I'll get this back. These are just donations, and they just did a Kickstarter that I was part of. And Andrew made his, I don't know if you know Andrew, he's the guy that's working on the film. He manages Film Scene, by the way. He's a great guy. They got their quota. So they're able to have this screened in two major cities, which makes you qualify for the academies. So,
okay, these are the last two questions, and they have to do with your uncle. Did he win the checkers competition, and how did he feel about being part of the national competition?
Okay, well, he loved being part of the national competition. And did he win? You'll have to watch the movie. So go online. I want all of you to go online and find out. I'm not going to tell you.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Before we close, let me just thank our sponsors once again, the University of Iowa's International Programs, the University of Iowa Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, as well as special sponsors Karen and Wally Chapel and Midwest One Bank. We also thank City Channel 4 for making our programs available to viewing audiences. So now, Kevin, as a small token of our appreciation, you get to have a coveted mug as well. Here you go. Wow.
Thank you.